If you want to support the show, you can go to mwpnews.com/support, where you can pick up my latest book, Succession Planning, and all my other books that have previously been released on Kindle for only $2.99 each. Thank you. Good evening and welcome to 30 Minute Reviews. I am Adam. Very long day today. Tired. Very long week, actually. We're a little late, but we're going to get into some of the newest stories. It wasn't quite as busy a week as we would have liked. Coming off of the highs of CinemaCon, all the studios are kind of slowing down for a little bit. But we got some stuff to talk about. Plus, because we're talking about this now, we can also talk about the trailer for Deadpool 3, which is, went up yesterday. Before we get into that, let's just go right into some housekeeping. Yesterday on Beware of Spoilers, I broke down Challengers, the new movie from Luca Guadagnino, and starring Zendaya and Mike Feist and Josh O'Connor. Pretty solid movie. I'd talk about it a lot more in depth there, but I think we're looking at a possible Oscar nomination for Zendaya. On the backlog files today, I talked about Pokemon XD Gale of Darkness, which is the wrapping up the edgy Pokemon saga on the GameCube. On Thursday, we'll be catching up with the Bad Batch, the most recent two episodes. On Friday in the morning, we'll be talking about X-Men 97 on Beware of Spoilers. That evening on Friday, we'll be talking about Boy Kills World on Beware of Spoilers. And on the 27th, we'll be talking about The Girls on the Bus, episode 8, I believe we're up to. I believe there's another streaming thing happening this weekend, but I just can't remember. Oh, Knuckles. We'll get to that eventually, and we will eventually get to Fallout as well. Before we get into the news stories, let's start out with winners from the indie space, which is our new segment where we talk about winners at various film festivals. Last week we had the Cleveland International Film Festival and the Phoenix Film Festival. Here are some of the winners from those two. The Audience Choice Award for we'll do Cleveland first. Audience Choice went to American Delivery. Excellence in Directing by a Woman went to Maggie Contreras from Maestra. Central and Eastern European Competition went to We Have Never Been Modern. The Documentary Competition went to Bye Bye Tiberius. The New Direction Competition went to Femme. The Standing Up Competition, which is Films with a Social Conscience, went to Secret Mall Apartment. The Ad Hoc Doc Competition went to Chasing Amy. The American Independence Competition went to Thelma. The Global Health Competition went to Small Town Universe. The International Narrative Competition went to Thank You Guys. And the Local Heroes Competition went to Rogue. The Cleveland International Film Festival is also an Oscar-qualifying festival for the shorts categories, so here are the winners in those categories. The Best Live-Action Short went to Room Taken. The Best Animated Short went to Anita Lost in the Woods. And the Best Documentary Short went to Michaela's Voice, A Letter to the World. Meanwhile, over in Phoenix, these films took home top prizes this year. Best Picture went to Etu. Best Documentary went to Acid Canal. Best Director went to Robert Budrow for Queen of Bones. Best Screenplay went to Max Zanis of Etu. Best Acting Ensemble went to Oki. Best Community Spotlight Feature went to Scarlet Winter. Best Live Action Short went to We Have Notes. Best Documentary Short went to Jack and Sam. And Best Animated Short Film went to Luki and Lights. And The Lights. As for things coming up, this Thursday marks the beginning of the Atlanta Film Festival, which will run through May 5th. Also running this week is the San Francisco International Film Festival and the Houston International Film Festival, both of which are Academy Award qualifying festivals. If you're in San Francisco and you're looking for something to see, Seeking Mavis Beacon is going to be playing there. It's a documentary that I saw at Sundance about two women's quest to find the cover model of Mavis Beacon Tika's typing. And also Sing Sing will be playing, which is an early contender for Best Picture, should it manage to unseat Dune Part 2, starring Coleman Domingo. It's about the program they have at Sing Sing Correctional Facility to help inmates reconnect and learn empathy through acting. On to this week's big stories. Story number one, Christy Carlson Romano reveals that Investigation Discovery came to her for a docuseries. About a month ago, we had Quiet on Set debuting on Investigation Discovery and Max, which highlighted some of the abuse levied at child actors and writing staff across the various shows under the control of Dan Schneider at Nickelodeon. This show also allowed former child star Drake Bell to come forward with the details of the abuse he suffered at the hands of one of the show's staff members who worked on shows like The Amanda Show. I'm saying show a lot. This week on a podcast with Mayim Bialik, former Disney Channel star Christy Carlson Romano revealed that she was approached by Investigation Discovery to do a similar show about her time at Disney. I want to be clear, I'm not trying to minimize what happened in any of these cases. What happened was heinous, and steps should be taken to prevent this kind of treatment from befalling people who work in this industry ever. This kind of treatment to befall people who work in this industry from ever happening again. I got to rewrite that. That's an awkward sentence. That said, the fact that they're pushing a second season focusing on Disney Channel overplays the hand of what ID is trying to do, and by extension, Warner Brothers. This is a massive corporation using one of their media subsidiaries to levy attacks against their key competition in a key demographic. And let's be honest here, there is no shortage of things that can be openly attacked and looked into without having to go onto a fishing expedition. They could have gone into the investigation that brought down Weinstein. They could have talked about the treatment of Judy Garland at MGM over the years of her contract, where she was forced to work 23-hour days and kept up on amphetamines and things like that. They could have investigated the dubious circumstances around the death of Natalie Wood and the decades of abuse she suffered at the hands of Warner Brothers. They could have talked about Andrew Kreisberg, who was one of the architects of the Arrowverse, who ended up getting ousted amid sexual misconduct allegations. They could have talked about Errol Flynn standing trial for statutory rape. They could have talked about the House Un-American Activities Committee and the role Jack Warner had in the creation of the now infamous Hollywood Blacklist. They could have talked about the accident on the set of Twilight Zone in the late 80s that killed Vic Morrow and two child actors under the age of 10 in a shoot that directly violated California state law. They also could have talked about Skylar Page, who was working at Cartoon Network until he got fired amid sexual misconduct allegations. He was a storyboard artist on Adventure Time, who went on to create Clarence and voiced the title character for the first few seasons until he was ousted. The problem is that Warner Brothers is using Investigation Discovery as an attempt to be a check on the rest of the industry, which would be admirable if it weren't for the fact that you're putting the industry in a self-policing situation, which never works. Historically, it never worked. We've never had an example of something being able to police itself and it working out well for the people it's trying to protect. It also puts ID in the position where they're maybe unlikely to report on things that reflect poorly on people currently with the organization or the organization's parent company. Considering how much movement there is within the industry and how many actors, directors, and executives metaphorically switch teams on a fairly regular basis, what's to stop the higher-ups at a studio from stopping a potential being produced about someone who now works for the studio? I think I said it back when I did the review on Beware of Spoilers. Had, you know, Dan Schneider come to Cartoon Network in the late 2010s with Victorious, and Cartoon Network knew everything that was going on behind the scenes, they would have taken that deal no problem. And would we still have this documentary out? That's a question that I fundamentally have. At the same time, each major studio, Paramount has MTV Documentaries and Disney has National Geographic, they have documentary film studios, you know, under them. How is it in the best interest of the people working at these companies to hope one of the competitors decides to look into what happened? It also has the chilling effect of, if I work on one of these projects, like say I'm someone who worked on Quiet on Set looking into Nickelodeon, what's the likelihood that I will get hired or have a film picked up by MTV Documentaries? So it's going to inherently have a chilling effect on that if we're only relying on these studios to deal with this themselves. This is exacerbated by the fact that most of these studios are now publicly traded, and allegations against people currently employed by the studio could negatively impact the stock price, especially if the situations look systemic and not isolated. I'm going to levy a hypothetical situation about this. Say MTV Documentaries is right now working on a tell-all documentary about something that happened behind the scenes of something like High School Musical or Hannah Montana. To be clear, I don't know if anything happened there or if there's anything in development. I'm just being hypothetical because that was, you know, a similar kind of show, live action, focused at kids, at a rival network. This is totally hypothetical. MTV Documentaries is owned by Paramount, and Paramount is currently for sale with Sony showing major interest in buying the studio. Now, Sony and Disney have a historically close partnership when it comes to distribution and other forms of income, So what's to stop Sony from being in this hypothetical situation if they bought Paramount and if they had this documentary? Like, hey, we have this project that could make you look bad. We can pull the plug on production or make sure it gets done and then just sit on in the catch and kill scenario if you give us certain concessions in our next negotiation regarding something else. At the end of the day, the WGA, the DGA, SAG, and IATSE should all be working towards some kind of regulation or independent regulatory body run by the unions, because the studios, allowing the studios to decide who can tell their story, when they can tell their story, and who could be the one to disseminate that information is a losing battle. This is not even something that the indie market can be relied on to fix, because the independent streams are now limited. Amazon Prime Direct does not allow you to independently publish your documentaries anymore because of the fact that they can't do quality control. So you're reliant on putting it up on Vimeo or YouTube if you can't find a distributor, which inherently people are going to be dismissive of. The fact that IDEA is sniffing around for its next big thing should be a wake-up call, not to the studios to get their act together, because I think by and large, like what Quiet On Set is talking about mostly is things that happened years ago. We're talking 15, 20 years ago. And I like, since then, we've had Me Too. Fuck me, I didn't mute my phone. Like, since then, we've had Me Too, and we've had, you know, Time's Up and all that, which kind of, you know, was the wake-up call. Because at that point, Schneider was fired from Nickelodeon. He hasn't worked for Nickelodeon in close to a decade. So it shouldn't be a wake-up call to that, but it should be a wake-up call that these problems are more pervasive than people previously thought, and it's not the job of the industry to make sure they're the ones outing it. Let's go somewhat lighter with story number two. Zack Snyder is back on his bullshit, as one would expect. Would it be a press circuit for a Zack Snyder movie if he didn't spend a substantial portion of it whining about his past movies? This time, rather than talking about anything, he's talking about anything but Rebel Moon Part 2 to Scargiver, for good reason, since the film's a dumpster fire, and instead he's going back to his greatest hits and talking about what he would have done if he was in charge of the DC Universe. Of course, he was in charge of the DC Universe, and his relitigating his tenure as the head of DC Films seems to be his new favorite pastime, instead of talking about the rich new universe he's built from the ground up that he plans to milk into a total of 6 films. This time, he talks about how the idea to have Superman fight the Justice League in Justice League came from a conversation with Academy Award-winning actor Leonardo DiCaprio, which is probably the closest Snyder will ever get outside of the one participation trophy that he has to actually being near an Oscar, where allegedly DiCaprio was one who suggested that. Famously, DiCaprio did not appear as Lex Luthor in Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, and DiCaprio has famously told Timothy Chalamet that he should not take a role in a superhero movie, but sure, this probably really happened. At the same time, Snyder alleges that Tom Cruise was interested in playing the role of Rorschach in Watchmen after offering him the role of Ozymandias. I'm not discrediting this outright because the timeline does somewhat line up. Tom Cruise did not have a movie released in 2009. But it is suspect that he's only talking about major actors who are not easily accessible via social media and couldn't be bothered to validate their claims because they're Tom Cruise and Leonardo DiCaprio. They have better shit to do than listen to what Zack Snyder is saying they were talking about 15 years ago. And let's be honest, it's not entirely Snyder's fault that he's forced to constantly relive his past failings in these press cycles, because the members of the media who are doing these interviews like giving him the easy layup questions designed to generate clickbait headlines. And he keeps answering them because it'd be rude to bluntly ask, can we talk about my current project and not what I did 15 years ago? On the other hand, it's a bit of an indictment on both Rebel Moon and what the audience broadly thinks of Rebel Moon that there isn't the same energy around it. This man built a universe from the ground up, and there is not enough interest in this universe to warrant questioning it and asking questions about what he wants to do next and what people care about the characters, because people don't. If it was me and I had a massive deal with Netflix to build my own cinematic universe exactly the way I wanted it, and previously worked for some other company who treated me as poorly as Warner Brothers did at the end of the contract, you could not pay me to talk about that over my current project. Relitigating Justice League 3 years after the Snyder Cut was released, 6 years after the theatrical, and on his third film release since then. We have to stop asking Zack Snyder about these things. Story number three. Fallout has been renewed for a second season on Amazon Prime. Amazon Prime's Fallout series has been a massive hit for the streamer, so So much so that the show has reinvigorated interest among the general public in games, including the much-derided Fallout 76. Coming off that, and to no surprise to observers, considering the tax breaks that were already given to Amazon to shoot season 2 in California, the show has officially been picked up for a second season. Ordinarily, this would not be a story that I waste that much time on, but the release strategy of Fallout has reignited the debate over whether or not the binge model or the standard weekly release model is better for the show for a show's longevity. We had this a bit earlier this year with Netflix's Avatar: The Last Airbender, but because Netflix rarely, if ever, uses the weekly release cadence, it was not that big of a conversation. The difference here is that Amazon does occasionally use the weekly release model with their shows. Shows like Rings of Power, Invincible, The Power, The Boys, Wheel of Time were all released weekly. Meanwhile, shows like Paper Girls, A League of Their Own, and now Fallout were released following the binge model. The staying power of shows released weekly is far greater than that of shows released all at once, and that's purely because it's staying in the cultural conversation longer. Even a show like The Bad Batch will be talked about 2 weeks from now more than Fallout because the show is being released weekly instead of all at once. At this point, it's a baffling decision for anyone to be dumping a series out, even for Netflix, even though that is their bread and butter, since all evidence points to weekly release being being better at generating interest. At least, hopefully, when we get to season 2, they move to a weekly. And looking at what's going on with with this show, I can say from my own experience that it is, I prefer weekly because when I see 8 episodes of something, I think of it immediately as a chore. I prefer weekly. Story number 4, we got trailers from this week. Transformers 1, Hitman, and Trap all got new trailers. So let's start out with Transformers 1, probably the biggest name. This one will be hitting theaters on September 20th. The trailer has actually made me less interested in the movie than the original announcement. I'm not a fan of Chris Hemsworth's Optimus Prime. I don't think the visual aesthetic is too interesting or different, which is something that we've come to expect from animated movies within franchises now. And I think that the narrative idea of Optimus Prime and Megatron being friends and this brotherly camaraderie between the two of them before they become the enemies that they inevitably become is interesting, but I don't know if that conceit's enough to carry the movie for me. The second trailer is Richard Linklater's new film, Hitman, which follows a relationship between an undercover cop who poses as a hitman to arrest those trying to hire him, who ends up getting involved with a woman who needs his help. Linklater, love it when he writes romance. He does a fantastic job with it. He did a great job with like the Before trilogy is some of is just fantastic. Glenn Powell has proven himself to be a fantastic leading man. So this is a film that I'm very interested in seeing when it hits Netflix later this year. Which is M. Night Shyamalan's latest film about a man and his daughter who go to a concert that turns out to be an elaborate trap to catch a serial killer who turns out to be the father. It's interesting that they revealed the twist in the trailer, even though the synopsis does not mention that, which indicates to me there's probably going to be another trailer, else another twist elsewhere in the movie. Our final story for the week, story number 5, Quentin Tarantino scraps the film critic. No one is telling Quentin Tarantino that he can only make 10 movies before he has to retire, and no one is strong-arming him into counting both parts of Kill Bill as one movie so he can fit in under this arbitrary limitation. That said, he has ceased work on the Movie Critic. I think that's the name of the movie, The Movie Critic. Well, it doesn't matter. It's been canceled now. Yeah, it's The Movie Critic. The film that would have been the 10th and final movie he released in his career. This would have been tied into, what was the other big one? Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and would have had Brad Pitt reprise his role from that. In a way, this is kind of a sad story. We're watching a man who's paralyzed by the weight of his own legacy and this misguided belief that if you make more than 10 films, you're doomed to mediocrity. Look at Linklater. We just talked about Linklater. His 10th film was Bad News Bears in 2005, that remake, but since then he's made Boyhood, which got him an Oscar nomination, and Before Midnight. Scorsese's 10th film was The Color of Money, which came in before Last Temptation of Christ, which is his 11th movie, Goodfellas, Gangs of New York, and The Departed, and last year's Kills on a Flower Moon. Fincher just crossed his 10th film recently with Gone Girl, which, had he stopped there, would have deprived us of The Killer, which was pretty good, and Mank, which, again, was Oscar-nominated in several categories. Dunkirk was Nolan's 10th, and while you may not have liked Tenet, Oppenheimer was fantastic. Acclaimed French director, who ushered in the French New Wave movement, Jean-Luc Godard, hit his 10th in 1965, and had a very long career after that, up until his death within the last year or so. Should Disney be concerned now because Cameron just crossed his 10th film with Avatar The Way of Water? Will that inherently mean that Avatar 3 will be bad? The Color Purple was Spielberg's 10th film, so does that make Schindler's List and Jurassic Park bad? It's a weird thing. The point I'm trying to make is that this idea that he only has 10 movies where he has to retire is a weird one. It's not based in reality, and it's going to leave him where he only has the 10 movies he's released so far. You know, again, Kill Bill, he counts as one. He released 10, but he only counts it as 9 because he counts Kill Bill as one movie. Or, you know, he gets stuck in this place where he's paralyzed by it, is one thing that could happen. Another thing that could happen is he ends up releasing a movie that he's so focused on getting perfect that it ends up being a little milquetoast. Or he ends up making, like, the smart thing for him to do, I think, in this situation, is to make Kill Bill Volume 3, say it counts as part of Kill Bill and keep it at 9 movies, and then do it while you work on a 10th. That's, I think, the smartest thing for him to do. Bonus time, we got the trailer for Deadpool and Wolverine, trailer 2, because they were behind on the episode. Anyway, we might as well talk about the new trailer for Deadpool and Wolverine, which, when they announced it on Sunday, I was a little surprised, because I would have thought they would have waited and held it till the week of the NBA Finals, which is on ESPN, or they would have held it for the week Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes comes out. The trailer looks good. I think they're nailing the comedy, and I think the begrudging buddy cop dynamic could be fun. What's most interesting about this trailer, to me, is clearly how much of Loki is required reading for this movie. The TVA and the Void will be playing key roles, and it seems like a not unsubstantial amount of the plot will be spent dealing with stuff in the Void. What's interesting about this is that they are clearly tying together. The interesting part is not that they are tying together key parts of the interconnected universe, because that's been the promise since Phase 4 was announced, where the TV shows and movies would hand the story back and forth between each other. What's interesting is that there's a negligible difference between the amount of time required to watch everything required for the Marvels, and the amount of time you need to watch everything required for Deadpool and Wolverine, considering both movies are two seasons of television. Division for Deadpool and Wolverine, it's both seasons of Loki. There was a concerted effort to amplify complaints about that going into the Marvels that is notably and noticeably absent here. This is likely tied to the gender and ethnic demographics of the leads of the two films in question. In fact, one could argue Loki is probably more integral to Deadpool and Wolverine, since it establishes the general multiverse rules, and someone can walk into the Marvels without having to have Kamala Khan and Monica Rambeau explained. And if they need it explained, there's two lines of dialogue each that explain it to them in the movie. I'm confident in the movie because I think Ryan Reynolds is taking it seriously, and he would not have... I don't think he'd be in this place if he wasn't taking it seriously. Like, I think if, like, he has the option to make Deadpool 3, I don't think he has to. And if Disney came to him with something that they didn't think would be good, he wouldn't do it. He's been burned by this before. I don't think he would do this again. And it'll be interesting to see how the movie plays compared to the rest of the movies, especially going into the next Avengers film. In 2 years, assuming you keep its release date. Last week at the box office, arguably the biggest surprise is that Civil War is held strong over Abigail, but besides that, the results are to be expected. Number one, Civil War at $11.1 million. Number two, Abigail at $10.2 million. Number three, Godzilla and Kong the New Empire at $9.4 million. Number four, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare at $9 million. And number five, Spy X Family, Code White, at $4.8 million. And you gotta hand it to anime fans. They consistently show up for theatrical releases of the movies in the franchises they like. Because every time one of these comes out, it's always in the top five. Coming to theaters this week, we have two major releases. We have Luca Guadagnino's Latest film Challengers arrives this Friday with special advanced screenings happening throughout the week. This film follows Tashi, a tennis prodigy who turns to coaching after a catastrophic injury ends her competitive career. Boy, did I write this copy before I saw the movie. You can check out our review over on Beware of Spoilers. Also hitting theaters this week is Boy Kills World, which follows a deaf and mute boy with a vibrant imagination who harnesses this imagination to become an unstoppable killing machine after the death of his family. Coming to physical media this week, we have a few big ones. The complete fourth season of Max's Harley Quinn hits DVD and Blu-ray alongside the second part of the animated adaptation of Crisis on Infinite Earths for DC. In terms of theatrical releases coming to home media, the surprise hit The Beekeeper from director David Ayer hits DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K, as well as Driveaway Dolls starring Margaret Qualley. Margaret Qualley. Let's take a quick detour to do what I promised a few weeks ago. We're going to revisit the Spider-Man movies because those are coming back to theaters as part of Sony's plan to recapture some of their lost revenue from their release slate being almost exclusively failing Spider-Man adjacent movies and a failed Ghostbuster sequels. They're re-releasing all 8 of the live-action ones. Up until Amazing Spider-Man, I hadn't seen any of them in theaters. Mostly because of age and younger siblings that would have been a hassle to bring to the movies. So, you know, this is a good opportunity for me to see all these again. The first Spider-Man was the one from last week. It's an interesting film because if I remember correctly, this is one of the first, if not the first, non-Batman example of a good comic book adaptation that's not afraid of what it is in the way that X-Men was. It's not afraid to lean into the campier aspects of the source material or anything like that. There is no, like, you know, oh, this is the suit we're going to wear because we can't wear the yellow spandex. This is, you know, we are leaning into full Spider-Man with a fantastic-looking suit. I'm not hugely sold on Tobey Maguire's performance in this movie. He comes off very, like, soft-spoken in a way that's unbecoming. I don't like his Peter Parker, and I've said that for a long time, and seeing it in theater really kind of solidified that, where it's like, he's probably my least favorite Peter Parker. And as Spider-Man, I enjoy it. That said, the film does do a great job of setting up the visual aesthetic to the point that it becomes a standard until the MCU takes over. The weakest aspect of the movie is the relationship drama. I don't like the love triangle with Peter, MJ, and Harry. It doesn't age well, which is one thing, but on top of that, it just feels a little off the whole time because I'm not a fan of two guys fighting over a girl who doesn't really get a ton of autonomy in the decision-making in the relationship. I do really like Willem Dafoe, though. Willem Dafoe is fantastic here. This is clearly going to be number one until we get, you know, more movies in, but based on my preconceived idea of what we have, I think this is going to end up being, like, middle of the road, because I think, or even probably lower half, because I think that, you know, we'll get to it in a few weeks as we get through this, but this is number one for now. Before we wrap up, we have a programming note. One of the major festivals we have to cover on Beware of Spoilers is the Tribeca Film Festival, which is starting to release information regarding its slate for the 2024 festival. Last year at their Gaming and Immersive Experience show, they featured games like Chance of Sinnar and Stray Gods, both of which became reasonably large indie releases for 2023. And as of right now, there is no major release on the level of last year's Elemental. We say what our coverage plan will be. Nor is there a concrete schedule to select show times, which also hinders things. I have selected 10 movies that, assuming nothing else is really there of interest, these are the 10 movies that I'm going to, like, of these, I'm going to try and cover a few of them. It's five docs, five narrative. But we'll see what comes up as the full release slate hits. That said, there is a non-zero chance that Inside Out 2 debuts at the festival, if not Inside Out 2, Kinds of Kindness is also a candidate for the centerpiece film, and they have not yet announced what the centerpiece film will be. They also haven't announced what the Gaming and Immersive Showcase will be, and that's not announced until Thursday of this week. Hopefully over the next few weeks, we'll be able to announce what we'll be covering for from that show and when. But we'll wrap up there for today. And until our next episode, have a great rest of your week.